Hello. I'm Earl Fontenelle, and this is Roots of Magic, a series of discussions of the history of magic with members of the research center Magea at the University of Würzburg.
Hello, everyone. I am Earl Fontenelle. This is Roots of Magic. And today we're welcoming Sophie Schutt, who is a junior fellow at the Magea Center, doing a little research project. Sophie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Before we get into your project, which is what we want to talk about today, can you fill us in a little bit on your background as a scholar? What do you work on? What have you worked on in the past?
Sure, yeah. So I'm a trained Egyptologist from the University of Copenhagen. Before I came to Würzburg to work at the Magea Project, I was primarily working on medical texts. So in the last 8 years or so, I've been spending most of my time working on a text edition of a medical text that's part of it is preserved in the Papyrus Carlsberg collection in Copenhagen, and part of it is in the Louvre Museum. So it's quite a substantial new addition to the known medical corpus in ancient Egypt. So I'm primarily coming with a medical background, medical background, I guess is more appropriate. But of course, in ancient Egypt, you know, magic is very prominent in medicine and really you can't really differentiate between the two so well. So I would say I'm a specialist of medicine and magic, and that's why I'm also here at Magea.
Yeah. One of the sort of tags that I use for episodes that have something to do with medical magic is just medicine, because it comes up a lot in magic and esotericism more generally. That's fantastic. Now, just as a side note, because I'm interested, is that a Demotic text?
This is a hieratic text. It's hieratic from the early New Kingdom. So
on
we're around.
Is it in Copenhagen and the Louvre because of the vagaries of the antiquities market? Someone split it up and sold it to different Europeans and it
yes,
ended up.
Yes, yeah. And exactly how that happened, we don't really know. All we can say is that the way that, so now the whole papyrus has been conserved, but how it was displayed beforehand was, you know, the Carlsberg sections and the Louvre sections were very, very similar. So obviously they would have been kept in the same collection or by the same antiquities dealer at one point in time, who then treated them, you know, in a similar manner, displayed them in a similar manner. And then somehow they ended up, in different first private collections and now collections that are actually accessible to everyone.
Right. Okay. Let us talk about your current project. What's the elevator pitch? What is your current project? What are you trying to find out?
So I would say, coming from this kind of field of history of medicine, I'm very much interested in social history and, you know, lived experiences in the ancient world. And so this is kind of very much the focus I have coming into Magea. So I'm interested in kind of the practicalities of magic. And I think there's one kind of aspect of this in ancient Egypt that hasn't been explored or at least not to such a degree that I want to. So I'm exploring how magical acts in ancient Egypt were spatially situated. So asking how, you know, landscapes and places shaped both the performance and kind of the perceived efficacy of magic. And so by, you know, foregrounding where magic took place, I want to examine magic as a lived kind of engagement with the world, understood to be, you know, animate and responsive to ritual actions. So I'm really trying to identify, you know, where magical practice took place in order to kind of understand some very, you know, very basic things about ancient Egyptian magic, I guess you could say.
Right. Like if we're trying to imagine the practitioner at her or his job, what does that look like? Where are they standing?
Yeah, exactly.
What are they doing? All that stuff. Now, that's a tough one to investigate, and I love that you're giving it a try. One obvious site of investigation, I guess, would be the temple landscape of Egypt itself, right? Because the temples, as we know from, for example, our interview with Martin Stadler, a temple could be, I mean, it could tick all the boxes of magical space if we're trying to define something like a magical space, such that even the way the inscriptions on the building are set up, it creates a kind of magical force field within the building. So that's obviously going to be part of the sort of macro scale, I guess, of what you're looking at.
Well, I've had to, you know, my fellowship here at Magea is only for a year.
Okay.
And so I have to be, you know, kind of very practical and very kind of realistic about this, right? So I've had to kind of scale down the project a little bit. So I'm focusing, because you know, magic in the sphere of the temple and in and around the tomb is very well attested.
Right.
And so I want to look at magic more as part of an everyday practice. Because the way that I perceive, you know, magic in ancient Egypt is that it was, you know, more or less pervasive in people's lives. And so I want to try to figure out where then magic was taking place outside of the temple context and outside of the tomb complexes.
Cool. So you're looking more at the magical territory that I'm familiar with in the late evidence that we see in the Greek magical papyri, right? Like sort of household magic. And
household magic, but also sort landscapes, for instance, how they kind of figure into this whole question of efficacy of magic and perhaps, you know, spaces where magic was thought to be particularly efficacious.
Hmm. So you've already had to narrow things down, but I think the evidence or there's a lacuna there. There's a hole in scholarly discussion, sort of beckoning you, saying, "Come study me. Don't worry about those temples and you know that stuff's been done. But what about, you know, your average person in the street?" What were they doing? How do we envision that? So then the question is, how on earth do you study that? I mean,
yeah, it's a very good question.
Yeah. So I guess, yeah. What are your, how are you attacking the problem?
I've kind of, you know, divided my sources into different categories, I suppose, or they are inherently in different categories. So right now I'm focusing on the textual sources and specifically, so from ancient Egypt, we have a number of magical texts that give, you know, different kinds of spells that you're supposed to recite. And then with the spells, you also get a short ritual instruction saying, you know, the spell should be recited using this and this material or in this and this place or things like this. So I'm looking at these instructions for the spells to figure out, you know, were there specifications of certain spaces or landscapes in which these practices should take place. But there are, of course, we might also include kind of a different text type like narrative literature, you know, different kinds of stories from ancient Egypt that give us some information on who the magical practitioners were and where they were performing magic.
Give me an example. What's an example of that? Like a magician character who shows up in a narrative poem or something?
Yeah, something like this. For instance, the Westcar papyrus, we have different tales of you know, magicians performing these fantastic feats. One of them is a magician called Dedi, who goes before the king because the king has asked him to perform, you know, or to show him that he can do magic. And so this the magic that he performs then is done in kind of the courtyard of the palace. And so here we obviously see the spatial setting of the magical performance as something that's very, very practical rather than, I would say, the landscape or the place having, you know, a special function here.
Right.
And this
so it's
is
just a convenient spot, basically.
I suppose so. Yeah.
Yeah. Although it's out, it's at least you can say it's outdoors rather than in the palace. So there's at least a choice has been made there.
That's true. Yeah. But that also probably has to do with some of the, like the practicalities of what it is that he then goes on to show the king, because part of it involves like cutting the head off of animals and then magically reattaching them, and the animals live on. Right.
Right.
So there's probably also an aspect of not, you know, wanting to bloody the entire palace.
Yeah. Love it.
And so these are the textual sources that we can look at. But then there's, of course, also some additional evidence, such as in iconography. We have a few, I would say, examples where we might see, you know, evidence of people performing magical acts that's being represented in different tombs. It's not very common, but I think it's important to include this information as well. And the final kind of type of source that I'm using is archaeological objects that have, as far as we can tell, a connection with the magical practice.
Right.
And this is usually something like figurines that might have been used in the course of magic.
Or birthing bricks, or little wand knife thingies. There's all kinds of implements that we find that are plausibly ritual.
It's true, yeah. But often these implements, for instance, the wands, or what we call wands, are found in funerary contexts. And so we don't know their original kind of spatial use or so.
Right. Yeah. So that's the evidence base. You've got materia magica, or what we hope we can plausibly identify as materia magica. And then magical texts proper, texts about magicians. And it seems to me that what you're looking for is something that's sort of going to be very evanescent in all of those sources, which is landscape, place, where, like the in situ nuts and bolts of how this sort of stuff was done. How do you go forward? Like, what are you hoping to tease out from this evidence? And how confident are you that you can tease out something really solid?
I'm confident that I can get something out of it, but whether it's what I'm imagining right now is, of course, difficult to say, right?
Yeah.
In terms of what I'm hoping that the project can give, you know, I see kind of several potential contributions. So for instance, by determining, you know, where magic was supposed to occur, we gain an insight into how the Egyptians perceived ritual power as embedded in space, and not merely, you know, ritual power harnessed through words or actions. And I would say closely connected to that, this project might also give an indication of, you know, these magical landscapes can reveal how the Egyptians conceptualized the cosmos. So, you know, certain spaces may have been attributed with certain magical properties, for instance, the desert or the floodplain or the Jebels, the mountains. And then these magical properties may then have been kind of harnessed through different magical acts. I think also, you know, knowledge of where people performed and encountered magic kind of deepens our understanding of lived religion or lived experience, and really grounds magic in a daily practice, which I think is also important. In addition to that, you know, identifying ritual places kind of clarifies the relationship between text and practice. So I was just talking about how we have, you know, these textual sources, we have archaeological sources that may or may not be able to be identified as being magical. So we can try to kind of clarify the relationship between text and practice. So by understanding, you know, the significance of places, we can interpret why certain actions were performed in certain spaces. And it really helps us understand how descriptions in the text kind of correlate with the archaeological evidence, which I think is something that's still quite lacking in the field of Egyptology. And one very kind of important aspect of this, to my mind as well, is that it really allows, I think, Egyptology to engage with broader kind of interdisciplinary debates, for instance, in ritual studies or in spatial theory. So it can position, you know, Egyptian magic within more kind of global discussions on how cultures ritualize the natural world. And I think this is particularly important for Egyptology because it's traditionally, you know, a field that's kind of very separate from other disciplines. And I think this is due to the fact that throughout much of the history of Egyptology, we've been very focused on, you know, deciphering the texts. And it's only now, well, not only now, but in the past decades or so that we've, you know, gotten to a point where we can really start to engage with other disciplines and kind of develop our theoretical framework alongside other disciplines. And I think this is something that's changing in Egyptology now. It's becoming more and more interdisciplinary. And I would like to kind of to contribute to that development.
Cool. I can see that. It's interesting how these, just the way scholarship developed in the 19th century in places like Germany and the UK and France have totally shaped the way knowledge is sort of formed and presented. Because, I mean, essentially you're a historian of some kind, right?
So yes.
One would expect to find your work in a history department. And just like all historians, you have to learn some languages to study that particular culture. You have to study all the social appurtenance of that culture, etc. But because you study specifically Egypt, you're a historian of Egypt, you have a whole department. And
yes.
It doesn't really communicate with the other history departments. And that's a real pity. The same thing is true of classics, the field I come from. It's just this weird made-up field that is a branch of history, but doesn't think of itself that way. It thinks of itself as a sort of standalone enterprise.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is silly.
And it's being perpetuated, right? Because we have these departments that are very much kind of focused, inwardly focused. I think it's slowly changing, especially with the younger generations of Egyptologists, and I hope classicists as well.
Yeah.
But also because it's a necessary part of kind of developing the discipline, right?
Yeah. Well, I think in partly because classics is kind of played out. There is a finite amount of evidence, although, you know, occasionally someone finds a papyrus or something and gets really excited, but basically we kind of know what's there, and a million books have been written about every aspect of it, and it's like, what am I going to do now? What you're trying to do vis-a-vis engaging with ritual studies is really interesting, and I think ritual studies actually has really interesting overlaps and potentially fruitful conversations to have with theater studies. And that's something that seems to be playing out a little bit right now that I think is going to bear a lot of fruit. Because the thing about theater studies is people who take on other personae habitually and get in the zone and do all this kind of stuff that's a lot like ritual possession and other, and, you know, sort of, there's some very theatrical elements to ritual. So that's really cool. But what I wonder about is space study. Did you say spatial studies? Something like that? What is that for the layman? Because I don't know what it is.
Spatial theory. It's about, it's about kind of the use and role and conceptualization of space in relation to different things, right? I mean, I think spatial theory in, for instance, archaeology is quite common, whereas in Egyptology, for instance, it's never really been, I guess, so necessary to kind of incorporate elements from spatial theory. So it's really just kind of a way maybe for me to provide, you know, a theoretical framework on how to kind of, understand the ancient Egyptian conceptualization of space and how it plays into magic. But this is really an aspect that I still need to work on quite a bit, because, I mean, one of the reasons I think for the general lack of interdisciplinarity in Egyptology is because it is really difficult to, you know, go into a completely different field and really feeling confident in that field, right? I know it from my previous work in Egyptian medicine, where I've worked a lot with medical anthropology. And when you first go into a new field, it just feels like, you know, you're back at almost like being a BA student again, right?
Right, yeah.
So this is something, an aspect of the project I really need to develop. And I think preferably with someone from that area of study.
Yeah. Yeah. Why not? Get as many friendly experts to help you out as possible. That's the best advice for anyone starting a new research project. Ask someone who already knows and just pump them for information.
Well, of course, because it would take you years and years to build up that same expertise, right?
And they're going to know, they're going to chat with you for 10 minutes and go, okay, I know what you need to do. You need to read this book
and
check out these articles. And also, let's talk about this. And then you've saved yourself a lot of fruitless reading and so on. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
So I find spatial studies to be kind of a weirdly resonant and fascinating concept. You know, space, it seems very, like not unlike time, it seems very straightforward and we all know what it is and we all know what it means and we all experience it on a daily basis. But then, as Aristotle notes somewhere, when you actually try to define what space is ontologically, it's really difficult. And then when you get into, you know, trying to find a way to talk about how humans, so forget about the whatever space is in a kind of scientific sense, but just like how we as perceiving entities interact with space, that's really hard to talk about in a way that, you know, are there rules? Are there human constants across time that define this stuff that we can kind of systematize it in some way? It's
at least in terms of magical practice and how, you know, space and or landscape is kind of incorporated into the magical practice. We see, you know, this isn't a universal, but we see some commonalities across many cultures. For instance, the use of liminal spaces in magical practice, right? Yeah. Because it represents this area of transition or so. And so there are some things that are shared among several cultures, I would say. And that's also why I think this sort of study wouldn't just be interesting for Egyptology, but also more broadly.
Mm, yeah. Now I think of late evidence that I'm familiar with from Egypt. So on the one hand, there's the text that survives in Latin, known as Asclepius, which I'm sure you're familiar with, in which Egypt is the temple of the whole world. And there is a very much a kind of macrocosm, microcosm, like everything that is in the cosmos is here in Egypt. That's some sacred landscape, right? That's like a strong claim to this whole land is a sacred landscape with unseen connections to the entire cosmos. Great. But then on a more granular level, what's interesting in the papyri to me, maybe in the context of your project, is where it tells you to do the practices. Where a given papyrus. Sometimes it says, find a room, and that's it. Mm. Sometimes it says, find a room and make it into a temple using this simple three-step process. Or sometimes make this inhabited god statue out of wax. So this is like the poor man's version of the temple statue of the god that's had its mouth opened and is being fed every day by the priests. Make that that statue and make him a little temple that you sort of set on your desk or whatever. You have to actually create a little mini temple. So for lack of a better word, the consecration of space or the rendering of space suitable for magic will surely be part of your research. And right. And I wonder if your research will turn up some interesting differences between that later, that sort of, it's not only, you know, so the evidence of the Greek magical papyri is not only interesting to us just because it shows the sort of demotic everyday practices that are not aimed at temple priesthood. They're aimed at like everyday folks, but it's also interesting because it's taking place. A lot of it is written down during or after the collapse of the temple system. So you have to figure out how much of that is a reaction to the collapse of the temple system? How much is this is like new magic that has developed in response to the Roman administrations pulling the rug out from under the ancient temple practice? And maybe your research into earlier materials will be able to shed some light on that.
This is what I'm hoping. I want to see if I can, you know, identify diachronic changes in the material.
Yeah.
And I think the best way to do this is by focusing on some of the periods that are kind of that are the best attested ones. And so I'm looking into material from the New Kingdom. So this is around 1550 to around 1070 BCE. And so this is, of course, a period where I guess we could call it like traditional pharaonic Egypt before, you know, we have all of these massive influences from first the Greek world and then the Roman world. And then to try to kind of compare that to some of the later material to also see if there are changes, which I have a very strong feeling that there are, if there are changes, what then could be the causes of those changes. Of course, it's difficult because what we have preserved to us, of course, only gives us, you know, some insight into what magic was like back then. It's a select corpus of texts and other sources that we have, so it may not be entirely representative. But what I can say so far is that in terms of New Kingdom material, which, as I said, is what I've primarily worked on so far, there seems to be generally very little focus on where magic was supposed to take place. Whereas when you get to the later periods, there is much more of a specification of, you know, this is to take place in the house, or this is to take place outside in front of the sun or in front of the moon, or different things like this, where, you know, then I have to look into whether this seeming development is then simply due to the chance of what we have preserved to us,
right,
or whether I can identify, you know, some potential reasons for why this development might have happened.
Right. I mean, another thing you'd have to correct for is the ever-present problem of they didn't write it down because it was obvious. Because everyone knows that you do this ritual in front of the sun. So we're not going to ever write it down. With ancient Greek religion, you know, we hardly have any instructions for how to do rituals. You have to put it together from bits of Homer and all manner of odd places. So there is that just sort of the problem of, well, you don't write it down because we're doing it every day. And there's this sort of living tradition. Why would you need to write these particular specifics down? So that's another tough one to correct for, but I'm sure you're up to the task.
Well, I will do my best in any case, but I'll give you kind of a nice example of this sort of, you know, how we might only have, you know, a very small portion of knowledge of these things. So I'm as I said, I'm currently editing this medical text, which is from the early New Kingdom. And in this text, we have three or four recipes that are performed during certain phases of the moon. And this is not something that we otherwise have preserved in the corpus of pharaonic medical texts.
Okay.
But so now we see that it was actually done, you know, different medical magical activities taking place according to the certain phases of the moon. And so it also seems likely that it probably, I mean, it may have been a common practice. We just don't see it recorded in writing, as you say, right?
Yeah.
So the more material we have, the better, of course. But then again, we can only work with what we have. So, So it's a matter of not overgeneralizing based on the sources we have, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a great. You're walking a bunch of different tightropes at the same time,
yeah.
and also trying to bring in fancy European theoretical frameworks in which to discuss this stuff. But I love it. It seems like a really promising project. How is it? I mean, obviously you're in the phase of getting your ducks in a row, as they say, or, you know, figuring out how to proceed. But can you describe that process? Where you started from when you started at Magea and where you're up to now in terms of the work?
I'm not quite as far as I had hoped to be at this point, but this is always what it's like with research, right? But so what I've been doing and what I'm still doing is collecting as much potentially relevant material as possible. So collecting as many sources as possible that have, you know, some kind of connection with with landscapes and places. And I keep coming, you know, back to certain texts where I've gone through them already, but then I read something and it makes me think about this text and I think, okay, maybe actually it's relevant for the project after all. So it's really kind of an ongoing process. It's not just going through all the sources and being like, this one works, this doesn't, and so on. It's more of a dynamic process, I would say. And as I think I mentioned, I'm so far I've only been working on the textual sources, also because this is very much a focus of the Magea project. But I really want to also incorporate the kind of the archaeological objects as well to see if I can, you know, bridge this material, the texts and the artifacts.
Mm. You have to at least try.
Yeah. Right? So I've been, you know, translating these relevant sources, trying to interpret them from, you know, kind of a spatial theoretical perspective or so. And for some of them, it's really been extremely kind of useful with this different perspective where it's given me some, I think, an entirely different view of the texts than otherwise exist now. So in that way, I think it's proving to be quite useful.
Can you give us an example of how, tell us about a text, how you used to see it and now how you're kind of approaching it?
Sure. Yeah. So I was, I've been working, as I said, mostly with New Kingdom material. One of the texts that has, I think, the most information in terms of landscapes and places is a magical papyrus in the British Museum, which, among other incantations, contains two spells against crocodiles, especially, but also kind of all dangerous animals. And one of these is within the incantation itself, it kind of has different allusions to space, like spaces in the cosmos, so that, you know, it's a spell against crocodiles, and it's really kind of with these spatial allusions, it's kind of serving to immobilize the crocodile by, you know, tying its legs and its head and its tail in different places in the cosmos. So one in the underworld, one in the heavens, and so it kind of gives a nice example of, you know, spaces that are cited, but indirectly. And so when you look at the text with this kind of spatial mindset, it makes you understand kind of the internal logic of the spell, I suppose you could say.
Mm. Cool. And that is a crocodile that's not going anywhere, right?
I assume not, yeah.
That is a seriously bound crocodile. Mm. I see what you're getting at. That's really cool. That's really interesting. I mean, again, maybe because I have a kind of cosmological penchant, but I think no matter how micro scale you get, you're going to keep having to go macro scale because these people are living in Bronze Age East Mediterranean cosmology with a Middle Earth and a God realm above and an underworld below. And that's super important for so many things. So the kind of world you live in on the macro scale affects how small scale stuff works. If you've got an underworld below you, it's different from not having an underworld.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really central to how these spells are formed and how, you know, their whole world is conceptualized. And so it plays a major role in understanding how the spells function.
Yeah. All right, Sophie, what have we not talked about that we want to talk about vis-a-vis your project?
Maybe, you know, some of the problems that we have with the different sources that we have. So for instance, the textual sources are, of course, the most, I would say, specific in terms of where magic should take place. But we also have to remember that they have a certain kind of socioeconomic context, right? So traditionally, it's been estimated that around 1% of the ancient Egyptian population was literate. And I think this is probably too low an estimate, but still we have to see the texts as having been produced, you know, by the elite for the elite. And so what does this mean for our understanding of the magical practice in ancient Egypt. I mean, are the texts representative of magical practice in Egypt as a whole, or do they only, you know, represent one aspect of this presumably very kind of varied practice? Right. And I think this is a major issue that, of course, I can't really solve, because it's a question of, you know, written traditions versus oral traditions. And for obvious reasons, we can't really access the oral traditions. But here, I think it's important then that we have the archaeological evidence to give hopefully some added information, even though, of course, interpreting archaeological evidence has its own share of problems, right? And here, yeah. I'm especially thinking of, you know, the difficulties we have in identifying, you know, what's a magical object and what's not. So a lot of these figurines, for instance, these clay figurines that we know from many places in Egypt, a lot of them have traditionally been understood as toys, but we can see from descriptions in the textual sources that they may well have been magical objects. So there are these, you know, difficulties in understanding the source material, but I think taken together, it helps us gain a more holistic understanding.
I look forward to seeing your research unfold, and you know, hopefully in a year or so, year and change, we can come back to this and see how it went, because you've just outlined some really tough, thorny, intractable problems that either a lot of progress hasn't been made in Egyptology despite people's best efforts, or just no one's tried to make progress, right? They've just, here is an object from a tomb. I'm going to call it this. We don't really know what it is. If you want to say, no, what is it? What's it for? What are they doing with it? It's a tough problem. So well done for taking on the difficult problems. So yeah, hopefully we can have you back on again at the successful conclusion of your project. You can tell us about your results.
Hopefully I will have some good results to show by then.
You will. I feel confident you will. And hopefully also not the ones you expect.
Yeah. Right?
That's another great thing about research, is if you let your ideas about where the evidence is going to lead you dominate you, you end up torturing the evidence. But if you let the evidence lead you, then you'll find new insights.
True. Yeah. Yeah. And for now, I'm really just enjoying, you know, reading through a lot of this material, because some of these texts I've never come across before. So it's really also just for me, very educational and a lot of fun.
Sophie Schutt, thank you for coming and sharing your work in progress, which is in a way kind of a brave thing to do. And I really appreciate it. I think our listeners will too, because it gives an insight into not the final finished edition sitting in a nice coffee table book form on your desk, but how you get to that, right? The process of asking questions, the process of trying this out, trying that out, thinking, well, would this be a good approach? And eventually coming up with some new and insightful research. Till we speak again, stay magical.